Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Hey, Sound Opinions listeners. If you support us on Patreon, you get to listen to our podcast ad-free on Patreon.
Who took the bomb?
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and this week we're going to dive into a classic album dissection of War's 1972 classic, The World is a Ghetto. We'll be talking with War frontman and songwriter Lottie Jordan about all of it. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. But first, some new music from Janelle Monáe and Jenny Lewis.
That is a little bit of a song called Float that opens the new album from Janelle Monáe, the fourth studio effort from this artist. It is called The Age of Pleasure, Greg. Janelle Monáe Robinson, singer, rapper, actress, first made a splash in the music world low-key with a demo album in 2003, but you and me became major fans with her first proper album, The Arc Android, and have remained so ever since. The first three albums, a trio of concept records about this robotic character, The Arc Android, followed by The Electric Lady and Dirty Computer, and now something rather different, which we'll get into in a minute. But first, a word about the acting career. Glass Onion, the second Knives Out movie, did you see it?
I did. Very entertaining evening of cinema, that's for sure.
They were fantastic. Yeah. Hidden Figures, also a great movie. I say they because Janelle Monáe identifies as non-binary and pansexual. And now, album number 4 at age 37, once again produced by a collective of friends, very talented musicians and producers that they call the Wonderland Arts Collective. Let's play a track from The Age of Pleasure. This is called Lipstick Lover, and then we'll give our reviews. Here is Janelle Monáe.
Tell me what you do when we walk up in the room. Yeah, hope it's something nasty, we can try it. Find me on my neck, and you know what's coming next. We can make a movie, I can ride it. Let's just make a move, baby. Cause for your love, I'll take my time. Just wanna feel your hips on my.
That is Lipstick Lover from Janelle Monáe's The Age of Pleasure, the fourth studio album from this amazing artist. You know, the previous three albums, you'd mentioned The Arc Android, The Electric Lady, Dirty Computer. I would say everyone is a masterpiece, if not a near masterpiece. Following up Dirty Computer, the Dirty Computer Tour 2018-2019 one of the best tours, bar none, that I have ever seen.
It was something to see.
An amazing artist on many levels. That said, this album is a little bit of a like, wow, you're just expecting genius from Janelle Monáe every time, and this is more like a placeholder. 32 minutes of music, including five interludes. So in terms of the depth of these records, you know, sometimes Janelle would get criticized for the complexity and the depth and the, you know, overabundance of music on her previous albums. That is not the case here. As it says, it's the age of pleasure. It's a party album,
mm-hmm.
unapologetically. And it's a perfectly competent party record.
Well, arriving at the beginning of summer, that's a good time for a party record.
You know, the breezy beats, you know, we got a lot of reggae, afrobeat, electro funk. She's blending genres as she usually does. But in terms of substance, it's about I'm enjoying my life. I'm enjoying being who I am. I'm a self-empowered person in this world, and I'm going to party with my friends. Very Lizzo-like lines here,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Rolling around with my besties, skin looking good, because we stress-free.
Rolling around with my besties, skin looking good, because we stress-free.
That's essentially the message here. And it's not that I'm disappointed. I'm really seeing this as more of a placeholder. Janelle is so busy that we're not going to get a substantive album from her. Maybe the next time. This isn't it, though.
I disagree, Greg. I think there is substance in the breeziness. Janelle Monáe giving us a record about the joys of having sex. All right?
Well, yeah.
That is what she is essentially doing. And it's very, it's rather explicit at times in a kind of coy way. I mean, it's not rated X. They are talking about sensual pleasure. And I think when you are a non-binary pansexual African-American, that in itself is a statement of empowerment, a statement of individuality. I don't mind having a little bit of a fun vacation with Janelle Monáe arriving perfectly in time for the summer to groove on those. Wow, I love those Afrobeat reggae grooves. I love the soul horns that that drop in there in Float. I love the Grace Jones cameo speaking French.
Ah oui, qu'est-ce que tu fais tous les deux là? Viens avec moi tous les deux. C'est ton ami.
I think that's a key to the whole record, Mr. Cotton. I'm surprised you didn't catch it. Grace Jones, another artist who broke every mold that you could name and went their own way 110%. I think that is Janelle Monáe's role model here. Everybody always compares Janelle Monáe to Prince, right? And there's a lot of Prince here too, but I think the Grace Jones tip of the hat there is a little bit more appropriate to this record. And I wouldn't be surprised, given the depth of this artist and the ambition, that the next record is some amazing concept with a new character. Forget about the Arc Android. Or I wouldn't be surprised if they just went off and continued the acting career. But I don't think so. I think we haven't heard the last of Janelle Monáe, and I like what I hear here.
Like a shot of good. A puppy and a truck. I don't play with Mopar, Tesla, Ford. I'm a Chevrolet Angel Lord. Trading my 64 Malibu for a van.
That is a little bit of Puppy and a Truck from the new Jenny Lewis record, Joy All.
Joya. No Tesla, Jenny tells us. It's a Chevy for her.
And, you know, Jenny Lewis is one of those artists, I think, as a songwriter, one of the key artists of the 20th century. We and her band Rilo Kiley, they were sort of the next generation of L.A. pop rock, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think I saw them as a bridge between that L.A. sound that Fleetwood Mac had in the late 70s to artists like Haim and Best Coast. You know, in between there were this amazing band, Rilo Kiley, led by Jenny Lewis. Jenny went on to have a solo career. We had her on the show back when her solo debut came out in 2006.
Show 19 on public radio, 2006. Right. Was Alex even born yet?
Yeah. Ribbit Fur Coat with the Watson Twins, an amazing record, very stripped down country soul, very different take on what she'd been doing in Rilo Kiley, and has continued to make sporadic solo records ever since. There's not been a lot of those records, but On the Line in 2019, a throwback to those Laurel Canyon folk country rock days when, she was growing up surrounded by this. Her mom would play these kind of records in the house, and it was a fantastic record. Now she's back with Joyal, and here's a track from the fifth solo album from Jenny Lewis. It is called Psychos on Sound Opinions.
I'm not a psycho, I'm just trying to get laid. Drop the bass. Respect to your guru. Namaste. Yeah.
That is Psychos by Jenny Lewis. Joyal. Or I think it's kind of like supposed to be said joy, y'all. Because there's joy, apostrophe, I don't know, Jenny. The essence of life is ecstasy, Jenny Lewis tells us at one point. And this album also, Greg, is a breezy summer pop album, more on the country politan tip than the old country Jenny Lewis has sometimes given us. But still, with that acid sense of humor, Psychos about psychos she has dated. And the confession in Puppy in a Truck. I'm 44 and it's kicking my... I'm seeing life through a margarita glass. I love this record. It is a bit of a shift. It is more polished and more, like I said, country politan. I think that 60s Nashville pop sound that began to come into country music is an inspiration here, more so perhaps than the more traditional old country or even Laurel Canyon. But, Jenny's not afraid to mix it up. I love that song Giddy Up, where it's this jazzy shuffle with the brushes on the snare drum, and then in come these incongruous analog synthesizers.
Take a chance.
But always the focus on that voice, which is a wonderful, wonderful instrument.
I respect Jenny a great deal. I think she's a great artist and a great songwriter. I don't think this album is her best work, though.
You're in a bad mood this week.
I was very much looking forward to both the Janelle record and the Jenny record because of their past work, which I greatly admire. And I'm merely comparing them to what they have done in the past. And again, as with the Janelle record, I almost feel like this is a little bit of a holiday for Jenny Lewis. She started writing songs at a virtual songwriting seminar with Beck. Kind of like, I'm stuck here. I don't know where to go.
In Nashville, right?
Right.
And also we did, also like Janelle Monáe, a career that began as an actress, a child star.
And I got to say, as much as I admire much of Dave Cobb's work, he's the producer on this record. She's working with him for the first time. He's done a bunch of great work in the past, obviously. But I feel like these are the most boilerplate arrangements Jenny has had on her songs, like maybe ever.
The analog synths over the brush drum jazz thing.
There's one example in a record that I feel this record is very flat sounding to me. There's no real surprises here. Country soul. I'm referencing Skeeter Davis, an artist whose height of fame was in 1962, right?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
I get that. She goes back to the past a lot and draws influences from there. But I don't think she or Cobb take that anywhere. And I'm a little disappointed. I think the lyrics, as usual, there's clever turns of phrases here.
Yeah.
She's dealing with, being a woman, a single woman in midlife, right? And it's great. She's very honest about that. I just don't think the songs are here. I mean, there's a few gems. The one song that I think really kind of hits it emotionally for me is that song Essence of Life.
Yeah.
It has some gutsiness to it.
The essence of life.
is ecstasy. Lean into the light. Well, sometimes you gotta scream.
But elsewhere, I just think it's a very light, almost flat sounding record to me, that especially after that great record that she put out in 2019, On the Line, is a disappointment.
Are you having a difficult summer? Are you not enjoying the summer of 23?
I want some records that will get me through the summer, and these are okay records, but I don't know if I could come back to them and say, man, I got to hear that again.
I'm having a better summer, I guess. But that's what we thought about the latest from Janelle Monae and Jenny Lewis. But as always, we want to hear your thoughts. Leave us a voice message with some comments on our website, soundopinions.org. Coming up, a conversation with War frontman and songwriter Lonnie Jordan on Sound Opinions.
Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island's been brewing beers in the spirit of Chicago.
You can find IPAs, lemonade, shandy, and limited releases in store or at one of Goose's venues in Chicago. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer. Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island has been brewing award-winning beers in Chicago that are inspired by this city. Take 312 Lemonade Shandy, Tropical Beer Hug Double IPA, and a rotating series of hazy IPAs only available in Chicago. Every time we go down to Goose Island, there's another one that they're pushing on us.
That's right.
All good.
Absolutely. And what supporters of musical culture, in the city of Chicago and elsewhere, if you go to a show in Chicago and you see that Goose Island sign, you know you're in good hands. They're music fans as well as great beer makers at Goose Island. So we're really proud to be associated with them.
The Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer. And we are back. This week we're doing a classic album dissection of War's 1972 recording, The World is a Ghetto, which became the best-selling album of 1973. Now you probably know War best from songs like Why Can't We Be Friends and Low Rider from the 75 album, but The World is a Ghetto laid the groundwork.
We have the great pleasure of talking with War frontman and songwriter Lonnie Jordan about the band's formation, influences, and how they blended so many different genres of music, including soul, funk, rock, country, you name it. It's all in there. Let's jump into the conversation, which started with Lonnie playing the keyboard and singing for us. Hey, Lonnie.
I'm doing fine.
Well, thank you so much for doing
all
this.
All the time.
It's a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you. No problem.
You can sing the whole interview if you want, my friend.
Oh. Okay. It don't matter to me. Yeah.
You are listening to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot with Jim DeRogatis, and we are here with Lonnie Jordan. What an honor to have Lonnie Jordan with us, co-founding member of the great band War. The 50th anniversary of the top-selling album of 1973, The World is a Ghetto, for more. Amazing stuff. Welcome to the show, Lonnie.
Thank you. I appreciate this. It's an honor.
Well, I'll tell you, it's an honor to talk to you as well. And before we get into what was happening in 72, 73 with the making of this album, The World is a Ghetto, I would love to get into the roots of War. Because you guys, the core of the band, you've been playing together for years.
Yeah.
Right? You grew up together, basically, a lot of those guys, right?
Yeah, we started, I would say, if my memory serves me well, I would say 1961 was when we started playing talent shows, and a lot of our schools, when we were in school, a lot of the talent shows in school, those are the gigs that we did back then. Yeah, we come up a long ways. And we used to simulate a lot of blues, Lowell Folsom, Jimmy Reed, B.B. King, Memphis Slim. I mean, the list goes on as far as blues and rock and roll, of course, Little Richard, Richard Berry, Chuck Berry, all the berries, mm-hmm. all the berries, Mrs. Berry. And we simulated a lot of country and Western music. I mean, from Patsy Cline to the Everly Brothers, Hank Snow, Ray Price. I mean, I say country and Western, not country, but country and Western back then. And and a lot of gospel music, a lot of Latin music back then, and a lot of calypso, which it was called calypso back then, not reggae.
Sure. Musical omnivores. You guys were interested in everything.
Salad bowl and a lot of classical music, not to mention jazz.
Yeah, there's a lot of jazz in all of what War would do. How did it evolve? Because War really spans, in my opinion, the evolution of soul and funk.
That's a good question, because to this very day, we don't know. We didn't know, because we didn't know how to read music. We didn't really know how to write music. Everything had to be an experience. Like Jimi Hendrix said, are you experienced? And that was basically our music. And Jerry Goldstein, our producer at the time, took us into the studio with Eric Burdon, and he just run the tape. That was our school. That was our writing tools. That was everything. But the writing didn't come to us until we experienced it from the streets. And to this very day, I blame it on our Rock and Roll Hall of Fans for giving us the tools and the knowledge to create music. And we collaborated with our fans. And we call DJs back then, but now radio announcers, we collaborated with them. And like yourself, we're collaborating right now for the fans to get more knowledge about my past and all the other artists. That's a good thing, because it's their school, to know from the horse's mouth.
Well, you had this pretty hot band. I mean, you guys were gigging a lot in L.A. Yeah. You had a lot of gigs under your belt. And then this guy, who's famous from the Animals, Eric Burdon, is trying to reinvent himself. And, I got to tell you, Lonnie, that blew my mind. Like, you go back and go, Eric Burdon and War collaborated? It was just, you didn't think of those two elements going together. How did that happen, that you met Eric and he became part of what War was doing?
I'll give you a little bit of history here. Eric Burdon, coming from Newcastle, England, you have to understand that was a coal mining city. And as far as the rest of England, pretty much looked at Newcastle as Hollywood looked at Compton.
Yeah. Working class.
Yeah.
Analogy.
So Eric had the blues. And so when we first started with Eric, we pretty much played the blues, a lot of blues. And it came out with Eric. And Eric, I used to tell Eric, I hate the blues. And he would ask me, why do you hate the blues? Because I grew up on the blues. That's all I heard from my mother and father playing B.B. King, Jimmy Reed, Bobby Bluebland, blah, 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 blah. And he said, well, so did I. And I said, oh, that's why you like it. And then Eric explained to me where he came from, how we felt the same vibes without even knowing it. I was much younger than Eric back then. I just turned 18 when I met Eric. And he put me in my place. And if it wasn't for Eric, which I take my hat off to this very day, I would not know how to entertain a large crowd of people and improvise. He was the one who really taught us how to improvise in front of people. We just went for it, didn't think about it, didn't care. All we knew was that we were connected and we were one with the people.
You guys had this out of left field hit with Spill the Wine. Mm-hmm. How did that song take place? Because I always thought that was really a unique sounding song.
Interesting. And it's a long story. I'll make it short. I had this groove on the piano, of course. Back then, I loved salsa. I loved the Fania All-Stars, Rafael Pagan, Willie Colon, Hector Lavoe. I mean, the list goes on. I created this song by borrowing some of their music. So anyway, I took that and said, now, Eric is like very dramatic and he's an actor also. And he improvises very well. Let me just lay down a groove. And we started this groove at a party one night at one of the Bel Air parties. He, my producer, Jerry Goldstein, and manager at the time, Steve Gold, had this party. And of course, they lived across the street from Conrad Hilton, okay?
No.
And down, wait a minute, down the hill from them was Jim Morrison. Jim visited frequently at now. They didn't never even knew he was there most of the time. But whenever there was a party, I was always there because I love parties, you know. The difference with this party is that I used to drink a lot of whiskey and smoke a lot of weed. But there was something different about these parties that I couldn't connect with. No one told me that I was getting a brain issue with something that everyone in the house was doing, called acid. Anyway, anyway, this guy was standing on top of the piano while I was creating this music for Eric. He was sitting next to me. I'm going, and this guy was up there, and he was wearing a Superman outfit, long hair. He was a long-haired leaping gnome, by the way. And he looked down at me and Eric. I'm playing, and all of a sudden, I keep looking up because I was paranoid. You know, weed back then made you paranoid. Well, made me paranoid. And I looked up and said, something's wrong with this guy. Uh-oh, something's about to go down. And I'm playing, and all of a sudden, his foot touched the ledge of the top of the piano, and he kicked it over on our hands, and Eric and I both moved our hands just in time. And I looked up and said, man, are you crazy? And Eric jumped up off the piano, ran upstairs. It took him an hour to get there because the house was that big. By the time he got there, myself and the guy that did that, which was Jim Morrison, and he had his fist up in the air. I bet you like the sock, man. I looked at him and said, I felt like Dr. Spock. Interesting.
Yeah. he had some problems, yeah. Jim Morrison.
Is this
father, the warmongering Vietnamese war admiral and all that stuff.
I said, is this an alien from another planet? So, and I said, and I put my finger on his chest, and he went backwards swimming in slow motion, and he went into the fireplace, not in the fireplace, but outside the fireplace in a fetal position, laid there for a long time until this lady came up and said, where's James? I didn't know who she was talking about. I said, are you looking for this guy? She picked him up like he was a piece of paper, took him downstairs. And after that, Eric Burton came downstairs, pissed off, shot the chandeliers out with the gun.
Wow.
Check this out. No one jumped except for me. coming from Compton, I jumped. I almost jumped all the way back to Compton. And then he shot again. And then I just said, you know, maybe it's time for me to go. That was the authentic personality of Eric. Eric was from Compton in a way. Yeah. He was a thug in his own right. That's how we connected.
Mm-hmm. Street to stage. Yeah. I got you.
I'm sorry for it taking me so long to tell you how we connected.
No, it's a good tale. Any tale that makes Jim Morrison look like a jerk, I'm down with it. There's plenty. There's a lot of Doors fan. So spill the wine. Where does that phrase come from?
Now, getting back beyond the gun, shooting out the chandeliers, we finally went into the studio at Wally Hyder's in San Francisco. And I just so happened to come into the studio later because Eric was trying to figure out lyrics. So was Jerry Goldstein and our engineer, Chris Huston. By the way, Chris Huston was the engineer for Led Zeppelin, The Rascals, and a bunch of other artists. I said, well, let me go to the store, which was basically next door. And I went and bought a big fifth of Gallo wine and some styrofoam cups. Came back into the studio, and I opened up this big Gallo wine and poured it in a styrofoam cup, not thinking that the styrofoam cup would stand up. It toppled over into the board, and the board started frying out, an expensive board. And Eric saw it, and he thought it was funny and started laughing. He spilled the wine, and all of a sudden, the engineer, Jerry, out of all that, they just thought it was all funny. So
sure,
we had to go.
You had a lyric.
Yeah, we had to go next door to the next room in order to finish.
I hope they didn't force you guys to pay for replacing the board.
Yes, we did.
Of course, yeah. It's the record industry.
Back then, the board was, I think, 25 grand. And check this out. We were in England, and that's where, you know, we hooked up with Jimi Hendrix again. And BBC 1 and 2 was playing Spill the Wine. I said, wow, they're playing our song. And finally, I called, some of the guys. They're playing our song. Finally, I called Jerry, and I think Jerry said, we're number two in the States. So I said, now I can pay for that board. And I did.
Yeah.
And I paid for it.
And just before she dropped it, she said, take the wine, take that girl. Spill the wine, take that girl.
Well, there were two albums with War and Eric Burdon.
Yeah.
In the middle of the tour supporting the second, Burdon has an asthma attack, collapses on stage, has to pull out of the tour, and now War is on its own. Is that accurate, that telling of the story?
Well, Eric pulled out only because he had political issues with MGM at the time, MGM Records, and he didn't want us to be a part of the politics, the red tape. So he gave us his blessing and said, you guys continue on without me. So he didn't run out on us. It was the record label.
No, yeah. Okay, and it wasn't his health.
Right.
He was angry at the label.
Not only that, but the label thought they had Eric Burdon and War Spill the Wine. And they didn't.
Yeah.
We were free, so we ended up going with United Artists, and Eric had to continue whatever he continued with them, he and Jimi Hendrix. That's what they did. Had nothing to do with us. So Eric was happy that we continued on in England, and he picketed MGM.
Really? Yeah,
he did. He and some other artists picketed, and that was right before they turned country and western. It was some bad news for Eric. He just did not want us to be. He loved us that much.
When we get back, we'll talk about the making of The World Is a Ghetto with Lonnie Jordan. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions. Remember in 2018 when Border Patrol separated thousands of refugee kids from their parents, deported those parents back to their home countries, and kept the kids in the United States? Believe it or not, 6 years later, there are still hundreds of families who have not yet been reunited.
Though we as a community may feel hopeless at times, we recently learned about an organization called Al Otro Lado, which works to reunify families. They provide holistic legal and humanitarian support to refugees, deportees, and other migrants in the U.S. and Tijuana through a multidisciplinary, client-centered, harm reduction-based practice.
Since 2018, they've reunited over 100 refugee families ripped apart by the zero-tolerance policy of the previous administration. Once reunited, Al Otro Lado helps each family find legal representation, housing, and the counseling they need in order to heal and get back on their feet.
Imagine having your child ripped from your arms and never knowing when you would see them again. We can't let family separations go on. If you're like us and believe that all families belong together, then join us supporting Al Otro Lado and donate today.
You can find the link to donate to Al Otro Lado in the description of this episode, or go to gum.fm/charity and donate today. That's gum.fm/charity.
You can also consider volunteering with the organization, which offers opportunities that are both in-person and virtual. The best way to get involved is by filling out an application on their website, elotrolado.org/volunteer.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
And we're back. This week, we're talking with War frontman Lonnie Jordan. Let's get back into the conversation.
The World is a Ghetto is album number 5. What kind of state was the band in during those recording sessions, Lonnie?
We were in a good place at the time because we had a little time off, and it took us, I would say it took us a month, near 2 months, to finish that whole album. We were in Long Beach at one of our rehearsal rooms. We said, bring the truck out to Long Beach, you know, where we're in the hood, you know, where the vibes. That's where our head was at then. And all these kids would come out there and say, who's in there? You know, that's a recording truck. And we would come out and let them know what we were doing. We'd get on the truck and play the music back, which was the beginning of The World is a Ghetto. And all these kids, we would take them down to the liquor store, not buy liquor, but we bought them popsicles and candy, sissy rolls and stuff like that. We bought the liquor for us. But anyway, I think one or two of the people that were in that crowd of young kids was Snoop Dogg. Our heads was in a good place because we felt like we were not only educating the kids, but we were giving to the kids. The kids was giving to us, enjoying what we were doing. And we said, oh, this is cool. And they were giving us more to write about. And they helped us take it to that next level lyrically.
That's a great story. When you're recording this record, you'd had a couple of hits. The recording method that I have been led to believe you guys used is that you would do a lot of jamming. A lot of the music was born out of the band being together, this band that had played together for a number of years already. Creating music on the fly with everybody playing at the same time. Is that how this album worked?
When you say at the same time, that meant Jerry Goldstein pushing the button, Chris Huston helping him push the button with his finger too, and letting the big tape, I don't want to call it the master tape, but the big tape running for an hour and then having the next one ready to go. We jammed. If you didn't push the button, we lost all creativity. That's how we created our music. Jerry would go in and edit parts, pieces, and just and he would take pieces that sounded like potential single or a song that we could write to, and it would always work out. We would listen to it and say, "Oh yeah, that's cool. That we could write something to that." Or sometimes we already had a story, and then he would take some pieces and say, okay, this would fit this and this would fit that. So then let's write something on that. One example is the Cisco Kid and Lowrider, by the way. Same thing.
All my friends know the Lowrider. The Lowrider is a little higher.
Same. They both came out of jams.
Yeah, all of them did. Yeah, because sometimes backstage before we would come out and play, like Why Can't We Be Friends, we already had a jam because we would jam backstage before a show all the time because we had time because there was always issues before we would go out. And that's what helped, you know, fights. So we had to write music to make them understand we belong to all of you. You know, and Why Can't We Be Friends being one of them.
Why can't we be
friends? And that's how we wrote that.
What was the story, Lonnie, that inspired the Cisco Kid?
Duncan Ronaldo and Leo Carrillo, which is Duncan Ronaldo's sidekick. Back in the days, I would say back in the 60s, there were no ethnic heroes, no heroes of color, unfortunately. All we had was Amos and Andy, and they were made fun of. But it was funny for us because we enjoyed it. I think they just didn't want the TV on the other side of the tracks to enjoy what we were enjoying because we were enjoying our own culture. That being said, the Cisco Kid was another culture, and we saw him decorated, his uniform that he wore from hat to toe, and we saw his horse being decorated. And for us, that was like in-crowd cars, which later on became lowriders. I'm in with the in-crowd. That's before your time. Dobie Gray. Well, he did in-crowd, and then we did lowrider after that. But anyway, the Cisco Kid, Duncan Ronaldo, his clothes was decked out to the max, and his horse was a lowrider car. Decorated just like almost like metal flake, like how lowriders decorate their cars. And so he was our hero, the neighborhood hero. So we took that idea or that concept and said, hey, he's a hero. Let's sing about him.
I want to ask a Muso question. I mean, you're a great organist, great pianist. You're all over the timbales on this album, including Cisco Kid.
Yeah, well...
I love that. How'd you learn to play timbales?
I love timbales. I was a drummer first before I picked up piano. And I was I was turned on by not the Fania All-Star, but the earlier, like Cachao on bass, you know, playing the Mambo, you know, like Ricky Ricardo, Lucio Ball, that type of orchestra music.
Perez Prado, were you a fan of his?
Cuba.
Wild man.
So all that, a lot of Cuban music back then, I was into all that. And then later on, then you had the Fania All-Stars, you know, the salsa. And I got involved with a lot of timbales. In fact, I had the great honor to sit in New York in Central Park. Next to me was two timbale players. It was Tito Puente and it was another guy. I forget his name, but there was like four pianos. It was a small stage. Four pianos on the floor. It was Charlie Palmieri and his brother Eddie Palmieri. And then you had all these Congo players. All these singers, and it was everyone was on there. Willie Colon. I mean, to name a few. I had the opportunity to sit up on stage and play with these guys, but I played my style. They knew who I was, you know, with War, and they knew I had a certain style. Pop, ta ta, pa ta, pa ta, pop. See, and theirs was like on the ones and the threes. Well, mine was the two and the fours, and they knew it. But it still swung.
Latin
boogaloo. That's what it was. That's what they did. So what I did actually corresponded with the music that they were playing then. You know, because I was swinging, and they were digging it, and I said, okay, and Papa D, our percussionist then, he would let me play because he knew I had a certain style, you know, and he laughed because I'm like looking at this guy next to me twirling his timbale sticks. I'm saying, what? I stopped playing. I didn't know who Tito Puente was. And I looked, said, what is this guy doing? He's twirling sticks. I stopped. And I looked. People laughed at me because I took a moment of pause. And I looked. I had to look. And I said, okay. Plus, I was high and drunk. Yeah. And I looked. And full of funk. And so I started playing. You know, I did my little any annies, I call them, two fours. And he was digging it. So I had a good time. I had a great time, man. That was so fun. Everyone was in the house. It was a great moment for the Fania All-Stars to be there all in one. And I'll never forget it. After that, I was even more turned on to, Latin and reggae combined, and jazz and classical.
The grooves on this record are amazing. We have to talk about the title song, which, when I first heard it as a kid, you know, it's this under 4 minutes long, it's a great track, and then I realized much later, when I got the album, oh my God, there's 10 minutes of this stuff. And it was amazing to hear that stuff. A track like that really sets the tone for the record. The world is a ghetto. Not just the neighborhood I come from, but the world's a ghetto.
Yeah.
So that really set the tone. And you were talking about the street kids and interacting with them. So that was directly inspired by that, I imagine, right?
Yeah, everyone of all genres, every neighborhood. That's what we were talking about. Every neighborhood. I mean, we even took that and went to city, country, city, talking about the city and the country, but instrumentally. People's minds mentally go into darkness, slipping in the darkness. It's all connected. It's all. If I was a DJ on the radio, I could take all of our songs and make a story and play the song after the next and say, okay, you were stuck in the four corner room. Why? Because you were slipping in the darkness. You forgot that the world is a ghetto. I mean, I can go on. I said, because you went to Vietnam and you lost your baby brother. You know, I could go on because all of our music is a story format.
All of the music is a story, even the long instrumental stretches.
Exactly. And I have to say, like when I mentioned slipping in the darkness, you have to understand that all musicians borrow from each other. Just like when you hear the horn lines and slipping in the darkness, ba-dup, da-dup, people say, hey, and they start singing, get up, stand up. I have to make it clear with people. Google and you'll see that those horn lines was before get up, stand up. And just to let people know that Bob, we toured with Bob during Woodstock. That's why none of us was on Woodstock. He was on stage and listened to Slipping in the Darkness. And he listened to it and he said, I love the horn lines. The next thing you know, get up, stand up. He wrote that song.
Yeah. Well, yeah, there was cross-pollination. I'm wondering how much...
We don't steal.
...of what what Curtis Mayfield was doing was influencing War in this period. Because I hear a simpatico, similar approaches, different ghettos geographically, but the world's a ghetto.
Curtis Mayfield had a message. His influence to us was grooves and messages. That's why we came out with an album called Grooves and Messages. He had a lot of messages, and he combined it with grooves, man. Everything that he did, and we had the opportunity to play with him on stage right before the accident occurred.
The lighting truck. Yeah,
So I loved Curtis Mayfield back when he was The Impressions and writing for The Impressions, you know. Sweeter than a rose of a cherry so sweet, and I'm so proud. I'm so proud of you. I'm so proud of being loved by you. Anyway, I'm your pusher.
Great. Good stuff. Good stuff.
I'm your pusher, man. Oh, sorry. Anyway, but you got to remember, Jerry.
You got it all down.
Jerry Butler came from there too.
I'm interested about this idea of War, naming the band War. Radio programmers probably would have been reluctant to play a band calling itself War, yet you were able to get airplay. And I think the meaning of war, you know, people have this immediate idea. It's the Vietnam War. They're talking about, you know, protest and all this stuff. But I think the meaning was multi-layered for you guys, right? When you were talking about a war.
Well, you got to keep in mind also, not only did we have a hard time getting our music on the air because of the name, but we also had a hard time because of the music. The music was different, and it just wasn't the record labels would had liked us to do. We need you to sound like this, we need you to sound like that, and then we said, no, we can't sound like anyone because we don't know how to sound like anyone else. Our mission, we decided to call ourselves War, which our manager and producer at the time, Jerry Goldstein and Steve Gold, when we came out of a cafe in Japan. We were, at the time, Eric Burden in War, still. We came out of the restaurant into an alley. And as we were walking, and they were walking with the promoter in front of us, they turned around and looked back and saw us and said, my God, thank God I know who you guys are, because if I didn't, I'd start running right now. Because we had these big afros and bell bottoms. We looked like some thugs that's getting ready to hit them up for everything they had. And that was during the Vietnam War, of course. And Steve turned around and said, a battlefield. You guys look like you just came from a battlefield. And that sparked the idea of, okay, war. We said, okay, let's just go for it. Let's see what happens. As we were writing our music, we realized that the music corresponded with the name. That's when we started realizing, you know, with the world's a ghetto and all that stuff. Later on, as we went and slipping in the darkness, we realized that we are in a war. We're raging war against wars. But our choice of weapons is our musical instrument. What our instruments do is it shoots melodies, rhythms, and most of all, harmony, bringing people together. That's our logo, you know, of why we call ourselves WAR.
Well, and one of the things the band was doing was uniting different cultures.
Right.
You know, there were the white kids loving you, there were the black kids that you grew up with loving you, and there was this Latin culture that was coming into its own, you know, with Lowrider and Cisco Kid. We're living at a point today where everybody is at the bad kind of war with one another, different constituencies, different groups. And it seemed like you guys were much more interested in uniting.
Yeah.
I do want to talk, because you were mentioning country and Western earlier as an influence as well, which may surprise some people, but the first thing I thought of when I listened to Where Was You At was a little bit of a country influence in that song.
Yeah, Nolens.
And I love that song because you were also asking, I looked around for someone to help me, where was you at? I think it ties in with the theme of the record, which is, you know, we're either in this together or we're done, right? But the country and Western thing.
You're absolutely right. And first of all, let me correct you. On the label, we put Where Was You At, but the real name was Where Was Your Ass?
had to change it for the company.
Now you wanted to clean it up a little bit. Okay, I got it.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. It's all connected. Like I told you earlier, I could take if I was a DJ, I can do a whole story scenario using all of our songs from 1 to 60, you know, of a story.
So a song like that, the country vibe just sort of appears with you guys just playing together.
Automatically. And by the way, we wrote a lot of country music. We didn't put it out because we had so many hits. We wrote a lot of country songs that we have not put out yet. And one we did put out, which is called So. I got a girl and I call her So. That was one, and I can't remember. We recorded so many songs, I can't even remember half of them.
Well, you'll have to save it for the box set.
Oh, or
we need the WAR box set, all the archival stuff coming out.
Yeah.
Thank you, Lonnie. It's been a real pleasure.
Okay, thank you.
That wraps up our talk with Lonnie Jordan and our classic album dissection of The World Is a Ghetto, and now we want to hear from you. Do you have a favorite track from or memory of this record? Leave a voice message on our website, soundopinions.org. Mr. Cott, what is on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, we reprise our interview with the great songwriter Cynthia Weil and her husband, Barry Mann. Cynthia died recently but left behind a huge legacy of brill-building pop hits that many other artists recorded.
What a songbook.
Absolutely. And do not forget to check out our bonus podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts.
The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this program belong solely to Sound Opinions and not necessarily to Columbia College Chicago or our sponsors. Thanks, as always, to our Patreon supporters. Sound Opinions is produced by Andrew Gill, Alex Claiborne, and our associate producer, Sol Delgadillo. Our social media consultant is Katie Cott.